Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to celebrate this thing called XP. Electric word, Windows XP. Some people thought it would be supported forever, but that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The After XP. Welcome, everyone, to App Compat and Modernization in a Fast-Moving Post-XP World, where we will pay our respects to our dear friend Windows XP. This is going to be an open casket where we have our friend in here. And what's fascinating, if you go and take a look at this guy, is all of the things that marketing people thought were amazing in 2001. Like, it does instant messaging. And it does wireless networking. That was one of the top four things that we could find. How many of you still run XP? Oh, this is the post-XP one. You'll need to come back to the XP ones that happened last year. Now, what I want to talk about today is to talk about what does it mean to do app compat today? And for those of you who finished, how many of you have finished getting off of XP or in the middle of it, you've seen some of it? How many of you thought that that was super awesome and you can't wait to do it again? That's kind of what's happening. And the question that then comes up is, well, I don't really want to do that again. So what we want to talk about today is agility. How do I get on the platform that I want at a time that I want? Not based upon when someone chooses to release something, but based upon the fact that it has value to me. Now, after that experience, it was painful for a lot of people, kind of left a bad taste in their mouth, but the thing that keeps coming up is Windows is one of the most stable platforms that you can choose today for your app investments, bar none. There's things that you can still run today that would be unfathomable on other platforms. To illustrate the point, I could not resist the temptation to see just how far back I could dig to get an app that would still run unmodified on the latest Windows 8.1. So I figured I would choose an app that probably a lot of you use in your lines of businesses. It's really, really, really common in the enterprise. Microsoft Bob. But the old people all just chuckled. So if you heard someone chuckle near you, they're old like me. You can still get Microsoft Bob to run on Windows 8.1. Look, here's an app compat guy. I can sign in. And just the kind of experience that, of course, everyone wants to have on Windows. Still runs. Incredibly durable application platform. How many of you run apps that are at least as old as Bob? Right? It's interesting. That's one of the things that we've really taken in and internalized is that the average age of enterprise applications is 12 years. Average age, right? Fascinating on a couple of levels. Number one, the OS doesn't even live that long. So you're actually using things beyond OS almost all the time. So some way to carry them across turns out to be really important. Fascinating also because we invest massive amounts of engineering effort to be able to support our operating systems and apps for 10 years. So I'm guessing you all must invest far more engineering effort in the apps that you're humbling along for an average of 12, right? Lots and lots of testing, and that thing is bulletproof. Never fails. But across the board, right, this is what we're trying to really carry forward, this incredible application investment. And that goes across other platforms as well. VB6. By the time it reaches end of support, assuming it doesn't go beyond the Windows 8 line, we'll have outlived Buddy Holly, the Betamax, our dear beloved friend, Windows XP. And we won't even mention the folks at the bottom and how they don't tend to run that terribly long. But these platforms last a long time. So we want to figure out how do we take this incredibly stable platform and use it in a world that's now moving a lot faster? Because stable is not necessarily the opposite of agile. And so what I want to share today are the tips, both technical and process related. Those of you who've seen me speak before, I'll let you already know this. Those who haven't, I'm kind of a geek. And so we'll be looking at it from the technical perspective, but I am going to stop and spend some time looking at it from a process perspective, because it turns out that really matters. And our most agile customers really bring the best of both worlds, the technology and the people and the process. Now, the way that we historically spoke about AppCompat, we love this framework so much, we baked it right into the AppCompat toolkit, is collect, analyze, and test and remediate. Go find it all, then go through the list and see all the stuff that you want to keep. And of all the stuff you want to keep, test it all, and then you're ready to go. That's the source of the really, really big project that many of you have recently enjoyed. And the way I like to phrase it is, this is the you don't know what you've got until it's time to upgrade philosophy, right? That's weird to me. All right, how are we going to manage our risk? Well, what applications do we have? I don't know. Let's go find out. Why are you going to go find out? Oh, let's go look on every single desktop and find out what these people have installed, and then we'll figure out what our risk is. Really? What do you do when you hire someone new? How do you figure out what they get? How do you train them? So the framework that I slightly rephrase this, I think works better. Rather than go and discover stuff that you'd never seen before, we should manage it. I talked with one customer, and boy, this guy was furious. They recently moved to Windows XP. I wish I were kidding. It's about 2.5-3 years ago. Did a whole project because they were getting rid of Windows 2000 because that was end of support. And they figured, you know what? Let's be nice and bleeding edge and go all the way up to Windows XP. Cut a whole year off of our life cycle there. And then they were doing a Windows 7 project because, once again, why be on the bleeding edge of things, right? Because, you know, we'll still be in mainstream support on that guy until at least 2015. So we're good. Lots of time there. We got a whole nother year of mainstream support of Windows 7. And he's like, you know what I didn't have anymore? The list of stuff that we just tested for XP a couple years ago. Already gone. Managing entails understanding your risk and what you're going to promise based on that. Assessment to assess how much risk am I taking on if I do a change, and then updating. An update is really important to me. It's not just remediate, right? Throw some more duct tape on that guy and get it to limp along another go around, but figuring out where does it make sense for me to actually invest in this versus just keep going in the same old paradigms. So let's talk about management. The number one thing that I notice when I talk to people about managing their applications is they have this incredible tunnel vision. Boom, there's my app portfolio right there. It's what's in Configuration Manager or Alteryx or Marimba or whatever I'm using. That's my apps. So you don't deploy a web browser then. So people never write any macro code in Office then, right? Oh, they probably do that. Oh, okay. Do you have any people that might maybe treat Office as kind of like a shell on top of VB6 and do whatever they want to? You ever heard of those guys? Every company has at least one. Right? The unlucky ones have a bunch of, how many of you have a bunch of those guys who are like, I'm going to do like the equivalent of like going to native Windows APIs from Access? I love those guys, right? They keep me employed. I once got a fully paid trip to Warsaw to go and fix the damage done by a small group of those guys. There's a lot of other stuff out there. So when we start thinking about apps, the systems we need to start building for understanding our risk and for managing our risk needs to understand that an app isn't defined as that which sits inside of an MSI. It's a convenient container, but we already have things like Office to go on top of there, web applications, we've got desktop apps, we've got modern apps, we may have some things in App V that we are deploying, we may have scripts, HTAs, I've heard of a few of those rattling around. Lots of things count as apps, so our systems need to accommodate that, and I regret to tell you, we don't treat them all as first-class citizens in our own management tools, so it then becomes incumbent upon you to take a look at that, but it's important. So I need to be mindful of all of my stuff, so okay, no problem. I'll just go find it all. Step one, collect. Go find everything. Do a complete and comprehensive inventory. And we get to that step in the space of the web, and suddenly we find, oh, wait, that might be a little bit harder than I thought. As we start thinking about what that might mean, I often do a lot of my finest work with this incredibly complicated and sophisticated application that actually ships as part of Windows 8.1 called calc.exe. Really, really sophisticated stuff. And I start to do the math of what people are saying. Let's just put a monitor on our proxy server and listen to see where everybody's going. Take a look at all of those. But here's the thing about the web. There's no standardized format of what is an app. We just see the path. And the path can be many, many, many paths for a single site or a single path for a site, and there's no set of rules to get at what that really means. So all we can do is look at the raw URLs. Now, let's say we were to take the raw URLs and try to distill them into apps. Since there are no rules we can encode, we have to bring in the humans, and humans like to be paid. How long do you think it's going to take for someone, on average, per application, to figure out what site a given URL belongs to? Throw me a number. This is very interactive, by the way. See, I'm all kind of up, jumping around up here. What's that, Andrew? 1 minute. So you have really efficient people. So we're going to have to be smart people. We're going to take account for that later. 1 minute each. The average number of unique URLs you will collect if you sit there and query the proxy server on an organization of roughly 30,000 people is going to be on the order of 400 million. So $1, that's easy math, I don't even need the calculator for this, times 400 million sites, and I end up with 400 million minutes that I need to spend doing it, or that many hours. Wow, that's kind of a satanic number, Andrew. Well done, sir. So I have that many hours, and let's pay these people. Now, they're doing it in a minute each, so how much should we pay them? They got to be pretty smart to do it in a minute. Let's say we can do it onshore or offshore. Well, onshore, $100 an hour. Clearly not MCS. They triple that. So, okay, no problem. Now we just need to go and approach our CIO and say, listen, we need to figure out what our web application inventory is. We're not going to test them yet. We're not going to rationalize them. We just need to align them to sites. So I just have my initial budget request of $666 million. Can I get that in small bills, please? It doesn't work, right? We're at over $500 million, and we haven't done anything useful yet. I add in Office documents. It's an order of magnitude less complicated. Okay, so now I'm at just 60 million. So now I'm at over $700 million. Now, on the Windows app side, I could actually get lucky if I do that way, right? The largest application inventory that we've seen of Windows apps so far, someone's always going to be a challenger on this one, is 225,000 unique applications in an organization of 40,000 people. And it turns out you can get that done in most of an afternoon. You can start rationalizing that. That's the only manageable task because it doesn't get that much bigger than that. But clearly doing a full inventory doesn't work. So for you, for your customers, right, the end users and the business to say, well, I don't know, why don't you go figure it out? That doesn't work. So we need to do a better job of partnering with them. The most efficient way is to go and ask them. And that makes us feel dirty because we're technology nerds and we're like, there ought to be a tool where I can program all of this. There's a quote, I have absolutely no idea if it is misattributed or not, but anytime you automate an efficient process, you magnify its efficiency, and anytime you automate an inefficient process, you magnify its inefficiency. And that's exactly what we do when we automate that. It doesn't make sense. So we need to figure out how we make that baseline list of apps that we're going to care about across all of the different app types that exist. Once we have that, we need to start categorizing them by how I'm going to treat them. The first taxonomy pass that I use on these is, let's look at which of these I'm going to choose to explicitly care about. My managed apps, the ones where I'm going to manage the change, I'm going to have looked at them, I'm going to test them, debug them, do whatever it takes, because I'm going to put some accountability on myself to ensure they keep working, versus my supported apps. Supported means if you have a problem, go ahead and give me a call. But you know what? Before we move, I ain't looking. I'll have no idea how it works, because it's not important enough for me to invest continually in looking at it. It's not managed. And what drives that? How much it drives the business. It's all about money, right? This is the problem with these things, right? Because when the numbers start getting into $1 billion, suddenly you're talking about real money. And we're not going to look at all of them. A lot of office apps fall in this category. They're supported. You have a problem? No problem. Go ahead and give them to us. In fact, I've even set up in an industrialized approach. When you have a problem, here's a file share. Stick your document in there. We'll take a look at it. And in essence, we're crowdsourcing what we're doing. But we're never going to have looked beforehand. Versus unsupported. Great. You can run this app. It's no big deal. Great. Have fun. Knock yourself out. If you have a problem, don't call us. We have a solution. You don't like our solution, right? Then you're welcome to make your own, and you're also welcome to support your own. And the final category is banned. I'm going to actively try to get you to stop doing this. You call me up, hey, I've got a problem with this thing. It's not letting me transfer all of my funds to the Cayman. Whoa, hold on. Let's go ahead and take that off for you. We'll go ahead and help you with that. Now the app's no longer broken. But you uninstalled it. Why, yes. Yes, I did. But really important, striate them and figure out what do you want to put on the line for yourself. And the next is to then striate them again based upon how important they are. Because if you treat everything as if it's critical, what you're really doing is treating nothing as if it's critical. And this needs to drive behavior. Just giving a label and a value doesn't make any difference. So when I think about this, and I like to use the Olympic analogy because it kind of resonates with people's thinking, my gold apps, they can't fall down. Behaviorally, that means full regression. We're going to get people in. We're going to look at all the functionality. We're going to ensure that everything is ready to go before we do anything. Because this is the thing that runs the cash registers at our retail outlets. This is the thing that runs financial transactions between me and the Federal Reserve. This is the thing that launches nuclear missiles, right? We talk to customers who do these things. You know what? Let's go ahead and do a really good job testing those things. Silver. I'm going to probably try really hard to get a user to come in for user testing. Make sure it works. I'm not going to require they go through full regression, but I'm going to have them poke as long as they feel they want to. If they want to test more, fine. I don't have to pay for them. But if they just say, yeah, nope, all looks good, and they move on, then we've done that. Some of the things I say is, you know, some people will say for my silver apps, I'm going to require they come into my lab so I can watch them come in. You know, others will just say, you know what, remote is fine on this one. But think about what behaviorally you're going to expect differently for this next tier. And bronze, not as critical. I'm thinking things like Adobe Reader. You know what? A, it probably works, unless you've done something really wonky with your group policies. But even if it doesn't work, we'll be able to fix that relatively quickly. There's not a lot of risk there. Sometimes I see them saying, you know what? My users don't even have to show up for the bronze. They can if they want to. They don't have to. If you just want to test it, do a quick install, launch, make sure the thing goes, and that's it, that's good enough for me. And as we start thinking more and more agility, one approach that I've seen used to terrific effect, it's what we use at MSIT, because at MSIT we have very, very different expectations in terms of how agile do we have to be, right? Because we are not, what's the word? Patient, right? The day that Windows 8.1 came out, our deployment rate of Windows 8.1 was nearly 80% the same day. So there is no more, yeah, we're going to take a look at that, and we're thinking after a six-month project we'll update it. That doesn't happen inside of Microsoft. So they've got to think, again, with their mission-critical apps, thorough testing, right, because we're running a business too, but with the less critical stuff, they take a canary in a coal mine approach. The apps are grouped together by similarity, same technology, same teams. They do similar things, and they tend to break in clusters. We'll test the first few in that group, and if they all stand up just fine and nothing fails, we won't even look at the rest. And we'll go on to the next group, because we got to go fast, fast, fast. Now, you don't need to move that fast, but you know what? Tends to work and doesn't really increase our risk that much. And that's what we're mindful of, is understanding what is our real risk, and are we actually managing it, or are we just checking a box? Because the most common box I see people wanting to check is, I've done something app compatty, so that if I get called on the carpet, I can say, well, I did this, this, and this. Go complain to these people who wrote misleading brochures. And that's what we want to move away from. And as we continue to think about management, outside of management of my list of apps and categorization and keeping track of them, there's probably one theme that's come up more than anything else that's out there, and that is sticking with known solutions. Tell me if this sounds at all familiar to you. Do any of you have that security guy who's like, I got to have the Excel sheet of all of the policies that are new for this new Windows version? And I'm going to go through one by one and think with my giant brain what would be the best possible setting in a vacuum for that one thing, and check the box and then hand it over to you to implement. Is there any of you have that guy? Because I've met about 30 of those guys. One by one, every single one, and you end up with these incredibly strange permutations. And just to kind of illustrate the point of how insane that can truly be, I figured I would use HTML5 technology to illustrate just how many possible permutations there are, even if you constrain the problem to only Internet Explorer. And this has volume, if we can get the volume up for it. So these are the actual number of different permutations of IE group policy. Those roll through. Here's a hint. There's kind of a lot. Screen after screen after screen after screen after screen. This is the complexity that we're dealing with. Here's a hint. We don't have that many test cases. Oh, by comparison, there's a number of molecules in the observable universe. That's the risk you're taking. More applications are breaking because people set their policies these days than I see breaking because they flat out don't work. And it's really common. If you ever tried to debug something where they literally customize everything, it's really, really tough. In fact, an article that I see passed around so many times is written by my friend Aaron Margosis, who's speaking today, unfortunately opposite my friend Andrew's session, so I gotta figure out who I'm gonna, you know, tick off by not going. Aaron Margosis wrote this article, sticking with well-known and proven solutions, because he's like, oh, for God's sake, will you stop writing your own custom, different from everybody else in the universe configuration, because it's not adding any business value and it's adding a ton of risk. And when it comes to apps, it's a huge amount of risk. So the number one piece of advice I can give for those who do group policy stuff is to not muckety muck around with your group policies until you have a reason. Now, what's really interesting when we think about security and some of the other things that come out is a lot of people are starting with their baseline, i.e., as one example, my IE11 policies, I've been maintaining and nursing these policies since IE6, right? IE6 came with this tremendously secure default configuration, right? So we'll just carry that forward and we'll be golden. Turns out that our default group policies, just out of the box for IE11, are like way more secure than IE6 was even after most people's tightening job on it. And so carrying forward the old really insecure with a few knobs turned actually leaves you much more vulnerable and certainly very different once you get to IE11 and you're comparing it to what comes to the default. There are some situations in which the default still doesn't quite match for you, right? You need to be more secure. There are configurations that we ship that, again, are known and tested solutions. If you have a super high security need, the U.S. government has the U.S. GCB, the U.S. Government Configuration Baseline. It's what every single government agency, all the three-letter agencies included, will use to keep themselves secure. Probably good enough for you. We have the security baselines that we provide for each version of the OS that comes from the cybersecurity group within Microsoft Consulting to provide that guidance. What are all those strange sounds? There's got to be something going on my screen. I'm going to see if I can figure out if there's some kind of video or weirdness going. Oh, yo, you know what that is? Yeah, Bob apparently doesn't like to be ignored. So let's go ahead and give Bob a rest. Yes, for God's sake, sign out. I, for one, am amazed that this actually works now. Farewell, Bob. So sticking with known solutions, right? Really, really important part of overall strategy in terms of applications, in terms of keeping yourself agile, and it's something that's commonly overlooked. So that's management. Now we have a sense, here are the apps, here's what's matter. We've thought about how we're going to categorize them. Well, what about assessment? How do we figure out, now that I know what matters, what works and what doesn't work, right? And it's easy, right? All you got to do is go buy the tool that finds it all and fixes it all and run it. Problem solved. So we hunt for that silver bullet. It's really kind of don't want to work. And then we end up on the other side. What's the word? Sad. And it's because of math that we end up being sad. Anyone want to explain that algorithm to me? Andrew? This is the Bayesian algorithm for posterior probability. The incident, you know, the probability of an event is based upon its overall probability as well as the probability that you're wrong. And this is the formula with which you can compute this. I've never met anyone who ran this on anything, so I went ahead and did it for you. Let's say I go and I buy what's the latest rage. I use static analysis tools. Some of them are actually really good. Some of them are not as good. But you always should run the math, and you should validate them on your own stuff. Don't take my word for it or theirs. There are no silver bullets. Let's look at what the math looks like. If I'm transitioning from XP to Windows 8, we see those tools now having an average accuracy rate of somewhere on the order of 85% accuracy. The failure rate I expect today is somewhere on the order of 21 to 22% in terms of failures in that transition. Again, as they say, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. The problem with statistics is I'm probably not going to be right on average, but that's what we see. 85% accuracy at the portfolio level means my predictive accuracy at the individual application level is 59%. Better than chance. Maybe not as good as I was hoping, because I'm going to be wrong 41% of the time. Are you prepared to be wrong quite that often? That's the problem with static analysis. And the problem begins to get exacerbated as it gets more difficult to look for things. Transition from Windows 7 to Windows 8. The accuracy rate drops. Why does it drop? Is it because they forgot how to write code? No, it's because the problem got harder. There are fewer mass things, right? You could probably write a tool that says these are all the things that will fail for standard users and make that your XP retirement check. And you'll be right most of the time because that's what most of the pain came from. It's harder to look for these one-off things. So the accuracy drops. The number of failures drops dramatically. So the accuracy at the individual predictive level is 12%. Oh, I'll be wrong 88% of the time. That's kind of a lot lower than I anticipated. I had one customer that was really like, you know what? I don't think we can go to Windows 8 because my tool tells me that fully two-thirds of my stuff is not going to work. I then pointed out his tool also told him that 63% of his things were not going to run on Windows 7, despite the fairly obvious evidence that he was already on Windows 7, refuting that claim from his tool. What about the browser? The browser's really, really hard, right? And believe me, we've worked really hard to try and get this assessment because we know everyone wants it. I've not seen a tool get above 30% accuracy. The transition from IE6 to IE11, our failure rate peaks at somewhere on the 25% range on the website. And so we look at, you know, roughly 13%. So I'll be wrong 87% of the time. Also seems kind of high. Where it gets really nasty is, what if I'm already on 8 and I'm going to 11? Failures drop, accuracy drops. I'm going to be wrong 98% of the time. So I probably don't want that silver bullet. It's not because they don't know how to write code. It's because it's a hard problem. What I'm looking for is a process, because I have to really understand what it means to be incompatible. There's no objective state of being a compatible or compliant application, no matter how many times we say it. What it means to be compatible is that you have no bugs on the platform you want that will stop you from getting your work done. That's the definition of compatible. Rather inconveniently, this jerk, back in 1936, that's Alan Turing, by the way, for those of you who don't recognize him. You don't usually hear him referred to as this jerk, but that's kind of how I roll in my sessions. Mathematically proved that we cannot find all of the bugs in an app. It cannot be done. The math prevents it. So therefore, our definition of compatible can never, ever be proven, which is somewhat inconvenient. So then what can I do? I can focus on that last part that stopped me from getting my work done. Because that's the part I can have control over. And that's why UAT is so, so important, is I need to understand that people can get their work done, whether they're doing it in a formal environment or whether we're doing it in a gradually expanding pilot. They are the only ones that can validate that. And if you think about it, if you have a software help desk today, how many of you have a help desk at all that takes questions on software? How many of you don't? Like, if you call, like, problems with software, like, oh, no, we don't. We only do the hardware here, right? Because that exists, you're already finding compatibility bugs with the OS you're already on. That's what those are. It's the same thing. So what due diligence ought we do? Because we're bringing in change. So people expect us to do something. They don't expect us to just go and just answer the phone when something goes wrong. They expect us to do some work up front to make sure that we're managing our risk and don't stop ourselves for an unreasonable amount of time. So we can go through and run some process to do that due diligence beforehand. We just want to choose it based upon what makes mathematical sense and ensure that we're tracking the outcomes. If we're finding this tool is incredibly accurate, then let's, for God's sake, keep using it. And if this thing just keeps being wrong all the time, then throw away the results and move on. Yep, kind of sorry I wasted my time, but it's one of those things that's really hard to predict. So as we think about the efficiency and how we move towards that, we need to understand what the tools do, but slot them into a process, not just go because a tool exists. this is a problem I see, and I work in a consulting organization, so we love to build together offerings, is what we call them in consulting. The offering just says, hey, here are the things we're going to do, so it's repeatable, so you get predictable outcomes, and everything about offerings is great. But a lot of offerings start out as run tool A, then B, then C, then D, then E. And that doesn't work. We saw that problem in Office. That was one of the more interesting years where we had this constant feedback. Office compat's really hard. It's difficult. It's expensive. Help us fix it. And we went out and we started looking at what people were actually doing. And here's what we noticed. Those who use the tools that we ship with Office 2010, OMPM, OCCI, and OEAT, are the three tools that are out there. Those who use them, the more you use them, the slower you went, the more it cost you, and they actually realized close to zero reduction in risk. So basically, here's an opportunity to spend more money and take longer. And that's it. That's all we got for you. Not a good idea. Tools lay on top of a process. Now, the process can be industrialized. That has been a really good success story that we use within Microsoft. Industrialize. We'll just have people churning through these things, understanding that all we're doing is due diligence and accelerating to UAT. And I think of it often as user cooperation management. I want to stop that thing from blowing up in their face the minute they walk into the lab, because then they get grumpy and walk out and don't come back, because they feel disrespected. But if I get it installed, if they find a bug, they're like, oh, well, I'm glad I came, because otherwise we would have not found this bug until production came, and they're happy about being called in. It's different, because we found the stupid obvious stuff. That industrialized approach is really useful, and crowdsourcing. How many of you were at the IE App Compat talk this morning that my friend Fred gave? Right? He talks about some of the things that we've been innovating on in the enterprise mode IE space about crowdsourcing, our ability to let end users and pilot users feedback to us what they're finding, so that we don't have to have a small central team who's wholly responsible for these apps that we didn't buy in the first place, that we have no quality certification on, that we just inherited. Crowdsourcing is really, really valuable, because we can't possibly know everything there is to know about an app. The world is way, way too complex for that today. Too much stuff out there. There's some really interesting research out there being done right now. This example comes from Cesar Hidalgo, who's a researcher at MIT, talking about how knowledge gets embedded across a network. And if you think about how that sort of applies to things, how many of you can build a PC today, start to finish? And I mean start to finish. I mean, get a pickaxe, go out, mine the metal, smelt the metal, assemble it, right? Draw it out into wires, wrap the wires, right? Not go and buy something pre-assembled and plug three things in a motherboard. We can't do that. I can't. Joel maybe can, but the rest of us can't. That knowledge is distributed across a global network. And this happens within companies too, right? I've got a buddy of mine who runs a big multinational entertainment conglomerate. He doesn't know how to run an amusement park. He doesn't know how to make a movie. Guys over there do. And we can't have one person know how to use all the stuff. It doesn't even make sense for us to try. So let's crowdsource. Let's find ways to make it so that we're not putting a tax on people, but we're partnering with them to keep moving forward and having technology being an enabler. In the end, successful UAT and successful sign-off and ready to move forward is all about how do we lead and inspire without any authority. These people aren't paid by us. They're volunteers. The other thing as we think about UAT and sign-off is to be mindful as we're thinking of agility, how does this all feed into stuff? It's really easy for us to slice off App Compat and say, here's this task, go get this done, and when it's done, we'll start deploying. And what most of the time we're starting to see happen now is people are tracking app readiness against device readiness against site readiness, so they know where they can deploy to. Hey, I got this whole team over here. They're ready to go. I don't have to wait. We saw people getting really, really good at this in the run-up to April 8th. They're like, oh, I do not want to pay any CSA. We're going to figure out how we can get as many seats off of there as we possibly can. So let's feed that together. Another story of management and understanding where things go. Here's the part of the story we haven't gotten finished off yet. Just because you work doesn't mean I can run you. I have not figured out the answer to this one yet, but it's a tough one. Here's an app. It works great on IE11. Maybe it works in enterprise mode. Maybe it doesn't. No problem. Vendor says, I've got to use IE8. What do I do? Ship IE8? Well, that's what people are doing, right? And now we end up with this conundrum. If that were a great answer, that would be perfect, except for now I've got this other group of people saying, yeah, you know what? We do N or N minus 1, so 11 or 10, pick one. Like, so I can't choose 11 or 10 or 8 or 9 or 7 or 6. There is no choice that someone's not grumpy about. Interesting. When did my application platform choice get delegated to Larry Ellison? I didn't see him in any of the architecture meetings, but suddenly he gets to choose what I do. So I've got managing. I've got updating. Sorry, managing, assessing. Now I have to update. Wow, three words, I already messed them up. I'm awesome that way. Update, and this is really important to me because it's not just about how do we hobble this across the finish line. It's all about how do I continue to make it better and understand where things could improve. And some of the things that feed into this discussion are soft numbers. Wow, people are going to be really dissatisfied if they have this awful, awful experience. If you've ever used a clunky old VB6 app on a Surface, the new Surface 2s, right, with the super high-resolution screen, so you literally have, like, the size of, like, 8 pixels across that you're trying to get your fat finger on, right, those old VB6-style ones. If you've ever tried to do that, you'll realize that's inhibiting productivity. Sometimes the business sees that. Other times they don't. It's interesting to me. I worked with one customer who was a financial services customer. They happened to choose to really focus on being the sexy place for people to come to work. And that, of course, starts with sexy computer hardware, right? Because who wants to come into their job and get handed one of those giant, you know, tank computers, right? The workstation class, you know, i7, quad core, you know, 16 gigs of RAM, right? Typical information worker, that's, well, yeah, the nerds are like, yeah, who has that job? I've got a Pentium Pro still. Yeah, see, the old people just giggled at that one, too. Right, I started to see a bifurcation of the audience. If you have gray hair or no hair like me, you kind of get my sense of humor. Everyone else is like, I don't know what's going on up there. It's kind of creeping me out, though. They thought they were going to inspire everyone with this great hardware, so they got MacBook Airs. But of course, they don't have any Mac apps, so they just used Bootcamp to run Windows on it. So they took their old Windows image, which happened to be Windows XP, and their terrific startup scripts, which took an average of 5 minutes to execute. So now here's this terrific piece of hardware. You pop it open, you push go, you're excited, and 5 minutes later, you can start computing on Windows XP. Hooray! That was their experience. So telling the story of that experience, right, that actually matters, even if it's not technology. When we think about updating, we also want to think now, in the post-XP era, do we have any technical debt that we have to pay? How many folks turned off UAC to get to Windows 7? Handful of you. Yeah, you're going to have to go do that over. Right, for a number of reasons. So if you go to Windows 8, and we'll talk about all of the gory details of this at my session on Thursday, which is Windows 8 Security Internals, it's foundational for everything we're doing in apps. So Windows 8 apps, the immersive ones, modern apps, whatever they call, the one formerly known as Metro, why we can't keep using what's actually, for the first time, a good name. I don't know. It's like marketing finally comes up with something that's not horrible, and they get it shot down. Foundation, it needs UAC to build that level of trust. So if you want to use that, you got to turn it back on. The other is sticking with known and trusted solutions. How many people, what percentage of folks do you think actually left UAC turned on back on Windows Vista when it was really chatterboxy? 88% still left it on back then. Of course, all the nerds are like, well, I would think it was 4%. 88% left it turned on. How many man hours of testing do you think we did on Windows 8 with UAC disabled? Zero. We have no idea what it does. I come across all of these bizarre bugs all the time. Hey, this doesn't work in the browser, of all places. It won't work in the browser. Like, what's going on here? Oh, they've turned off UAC. Aha! That's why it's different. I have a technical debt there. What if my remediation strategy was MedV? Or Virtualize XP or Server 2003? I've got to pay back that technical debt and move off. What about my shims, right? That's my duct tape to limp them over the finish line. Am I going to go back and fix those things, or do I need to keep them limping along? Do I need to fix that? An interesting side note when it comes to shims, for all of the, any of you shim nerds out there at all? Right, so a few shim nerds. One of the things that we did for Windows 8 was we fixed a bug. And I hate when we fix bugs in the compatibility infrastructure because that just breaks stuff. We fixed a bug. We had a global exclude for all managed code. Managed code did not get shimmed unless you specifically include it. But rather conveniently, we had a bug in the shim infrastructure that didn't look at the global excludes at all. Never saw them. So we fixed that for Windows 8. So suddenly, .NET apps stopped being shimmed. We put the bug back in for the 8.1 update. So now your .NET apps will be shimmed again. So we heard that, we saw it, right, and we fed it back. And I consider my job to be kind of like, you know, the person to hunt down and destroy all the enterprise blockers and represent you to the product group. Because engineering, it's not that they don't care, but they truly do. They live in this world where they don't get to talk to you. And a lot of the information that you think is obvious is really, truly trapped behind your firewall. We don't know. It's a blind spot. It wasn't until in 2006 I started getting on airplanes to go and step on the other side of the firewall and talk to everybody that I started to get a real good perception of what that was. So we're although we seem like we're kind of idiots sometimes, we're really not, and we're investing really hard in the enterprise, and we want to understand that. As we think about updating, we want to make sure that we're going through and mercilessly hunting down and destroying the brittleness that we find. Hey, this app, every single time I have to go in and do these heroics to get it across the line. Well, at what point do you pull the plug and say, could you make this less terrible, please? Reflect upon the things that you find that are causing you pain, whether you know it or not. I usually like to pick on Microsoft because we're kind of fair game, but I'll pick on someone else because every single customer I talk to has to deal with this. There's been a bit of a transformation when it comes to security in terms of what's actually out there being exploited. How many of you have an app or some apps that require you to run not the latest JVM? Yeah, so here's some numbers that might make you think that's not such a good idea. So this is the number of exploit kits you can go out and find and what they're targeting. And where have they moved to? Oh, look at that blue bar. What does that correspond to? Oh, that's Java. Why? Because the bad guys have figured out that all of you are running old ones. They're like, oh, I don't even have to try. I don't have to say, oh, I wonder if these guys haven't patched yet. I know they haven't patched because nobody's patched. You're like, well, that's just statistics. Those are just kits that they can get. What I really care about is what is actually being exploited. Oh, that's even worse. If I have apps that are demanding old versions of something that's really, really risky, just saying, meh, what can I do? Not a great idea. How do we get rid of that brittleness and move forward? When we think about apps, what's the number one problem we see going from Windows 7 to Windows 8? It's not that the stuff doesn't work. It's version numbers. Hey, are you someone I know? Oh, you're not? Well, I'm not going to play with you anymore then. Here's what we did. It's kind of sneaky. I love sneaky stuff. So if I go and I run an app, and you know, if you want to, are there any developers or should I skip the code? No developers? Oh, Andrew, you don't count. All I'm doing is I'm calling the get version API. Now, brief intro on version numbers. Windows XP was 5.1. Windows Vista was 6.0. When it came time to name Windows 7, the most obvious choice, if you're in marketing, would be 7.0, right? Yeah, no, not so much. You know why? What's more compatible? And the number one way that we saw people checking to see if you had Windows XP, if version major is greater than or equal to 5, and version minor is greater than or equal to 1. That's how they'd write it. Some fantastic code right there. Written a huge, huge number of times. What's wrong with that logic when Windows XP is the most current one out there? Nothing. What's wrong with that on Windows Vista? Is 6 greater than or equal to 5? Yep, we're good. Is 0 greater than or equal to 1? Oh, no. Seemed good because I'm bad at logic. We're bad at stats now and logic. Wow, we are not winning on the math side here. So 6.1, is 6 greater than or equal to 5? Yes. Is 1 greater than or equal to 1? Yes. We have a winner. And that's how Windows 7's version got named. Windows 8, hey, same idea. 6.2. And then we got even smarter. 8.1. If I just call get version, what's it going to tell me? I'm 6.2. It translates to, hi, I'm Windows 8. It's nice to meet you. Until such time as I say, you know what? I know the password. Let's go ahead and rename this guy. This is a manifest file. Normally they're inside. I brought it outside so we could see it. And what this does is it's a bit of XML that just says, you know, describes stuff about the app. It's how we ask for UAC run levels. This is what the developers do for that. And at the bottom, we've got this compatibility piece that says, hey, you know, I am compatible with Windows 8.1. I'm your friend. I know all about you. I've tested you, and we're good. Let's carry forward. This GUID wasn't released until there was an 8.1, so we know they probably, hopefully, at least tried it. And as soon as you have that in place to say, hey, I know about you. Oh, that's awesome. It's cached the manifest. Oh, way to kill my demo. Whoops, not delete. Let's try renaming it. XE.manifest. Yep, okay. Sorry. That's the other beauty of Windows Explorer is it likes to cache everything. So therefore I run into a cache every now and then. It fouls me up on manifest because normally people don't dynamically modify their application manifest, so why would there be an optimization around not doing that? With the manifest, we'll just tell the truth. Oh, you know about 8.1? Yeah, well, I'm that. And until you do, we'll just keep lying. We just kind of stop changing the version number to most apps to get rid of that problem because it's a really irritating problem. So that's how we're testing that. What's the other challenge we see going to 8.1? Off of Windows 7? What do you think the hardest thing is? Any guesses? DPI? No? Web apps. So we actually had a time to interview the person who runs Internet Explorer Labs, and we'll hear her talking about that right now.
Oh, hello. My name is Dr. Abby, famous rocket scientist and the director of Internet Explorer Labs. Here at Internet Explorer Labs, We think a lot about African fashion. We think anyone who's moving to the latest Internet Explorer, we figured if there was a site that wasn't compatible, well, my goodness, they just rip out Fiddler. They debug that site, and when they figure out what was wrong, well, they just hack into the web server, and they just modify the HTML right on the server. I mean, obviously. Well, then we did some focus groups, and we found the number of people who did that for Leslie, zero. And we thought we might need a new strategy. So I invented Enterprise Mode IE. You have a site that doesn't work anymore. All you have to do is put it in Enterprise Mode. If it works, and all you have to do is hack into the server and replace the Enterprise Mode XML. Duh. Enterprise Mode IE. Just another way that we at an Internet Explorer Labs are bringing you the future today. Now if you're following me, I have to work on implementing the new HTML5 spell tag.
So while a bit of hyperbole about how we got there, there's some element of truth to that. What do you do when you run across a site that doesn't work? And the management story was a bit difficult. Here, in fact, is what we found when we started talking to customers, and there was a big escalation, right? This all sort of sprung from a little announcement we made that, believe me, I noticed that announcement, when we said Office 365 will stop supporting IE8 on April 8th of 2014. How many of you heard that announcement and went, oh, dear God? Because kind of the whole earth collectively sort of gasped. And when the entire earth is gasping, you know who hears that? Steve Ballmer hears that, right, at the time. Would have been Satya today. And then whenever Steve Ballmer hears things about App Compat, oddly, I end up on airplanes not long after that. So we went and started talking to customers, and here's what we found. We found that the cost of remediation has truly come down phenomenally. It was hard to get off of IE6 and expensive, and I had to invest a lot in my apps. And it kept getting easier in terms of remediation costs, and that was what we were razor sharp focused on, the cost of remediation. Bring it down, 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 and we got to the point where the cost of remediation was really, really low. If a site doesn't work in the doc mode we hand it by default, almost all the time, we can drop it to another one and get it working. Almost. Here's the problem. If we're not defaulting you to the right one, then you still have to test them. And it turns out that testing also costs money. Who knew? So how do we fix that? And so we looked at that, and we also looked at really what I see as the significant bifurcation of web applications out in the world today. There really are two primary categories, and you can kind of get into the subtle details, but they'll probably resonate true. The web services that you're seeing out there, folks who are putting things out there for general consumption, trying hard to differentiate, those applications are really looking to take advantage of all of the stuff the web is doing right now. HTML5 and its latest iterations as fast as it can go to make a super compelling user experience. And they have converged upon the emerging standard of N or N-1 as their support posture because they can't afford to do anything else. If you think about, you know, a Chrome or Firefox iterating once every 6 to 8 weeks, you can't support stuff for 10 years. Otherwise, you'd have to support like 40 versions of the browser. You can't test that many and keep it working. And that applies to us too. So I always want to have latest or pretty darn close to it for one category of web apps. Then there's the I'm going to go and buy SAP, Siebel, Oracle, PeopleSoft, you know, all of the big ERP, all the big CRM, Dynamics, buy a product that spews out HTML from my on-premise server, plant it in there with a project that takes me 4 years, and let it sit for a while, and it's not updating all the time. I want some stability. There are those two, right? Or I wrote my own, and my team doesn't want to keep doing it. It's not like the guys at Facebook who have an app. We have thousands of apps to manage. We can't just be sit there constantly iterating like, oh, hey, there's a new tag available. I'll go see if I can make use of that somehow. No, it's like I wrote it. It solved the problem. I'm going to go do something else because I'm busy. Bifurcation. So this notion of punctuated equilibrium is where we're trying to get to. This sense that I'm going to have one platform that's going to stay the same for a while. And then will let me move up so I can start taking advantage of new stuff. But I have that while, and what I am hearing from customers, and you may disagree, but you'll probably say, you know what, I can kind of get that. Somewhere on the order of 6 to 8 years is what people find is reasonable. What they want is the red one. I'd like to make it and have it go forever. The gold standard I'm hearing is mainframe apps. I have a mainframe app that was written in 1967, still running today. That's the gold standard. We're not aspirational to do that today. We are aspirational to bring this punctuated equilibrium so you have a stable platform for a while, and that's what enterprise mode is designed to bring. Now, there was a whole presentation on enterprise mode, so I don't want to belabor the point and go into details on that, but instead wanted to showcase some of the things that we're trying to achieve with enterprise mode. And I'm going to use real-world apps that are out there. And I'm going to worry that some of the apps are going to potentially have been fixed in the interim, although they were good as of half an hour ago, or I guess 40 minutes ago now. This is a real live application. It's Centricity Enterprise Web. I don't know if there's any Centricity guys in here. If so, this is an awesome one because, sorry, I'm going to pick on the poor Centricity guys. But I debug it a lot, and it actually fixes beautifully. So I'll show you real quick what the challenge is. So if I go in here and I go into checks.js, and I've got the whole, if you want to see the debugging, in previous tech ads, I've actually done the full debug on this one. I'm not going to repeat that here in the interest of time and repeating myself, but I'm going to look for the word sufficient, and then I'm going to use this cool little F12 thing that shows me where the word appears. And here we go, and here's what we're doing for the check. Are you, for the script engine, version 10 or 9 or 5.8 or 5.7 or 5.6? And if you're not one of these, I don't know you. I'm going to say go away. I've never heard of you before. So number one, if anyone has like maybe $30 extra, if we can buy the team a keyboard that has a greater than key on it, that would be really helpful. I'm sorry. It's better than what we had before. I get why they're doing this, because this stuff is really matters, right? So I can make fun of it, but let's be honest. This is people's lives. This is what doctors use to determine and look at your radiology charts, right? And I don't know all the, I'm not a doctor. One of my really close friends, he is the director of functional and stereotactic neurosurgery at Northwestern University, and this is the hospital he's running this from. We have a deal going on. Anytime his computer breaks, he calls me, and anytime my brain breaks, I call him. But believe me, in this industry, you don't just say, I'm sure every browser will work. You probably want to look at it and give a warning that says, hey, you know what? We've actually not tested you. That's fair. I kind of wish it wouldn't block me from going further, but at least it's giving me a sense there. What enterprise mode will do is, this is one of the bugs I put in specifically for this app, is I said, I put it in the enterprise mode. I wanted a version live for the script engine. So now, it passes all the checks and loads the app. Simple as that. Because otherwise, this was not fixed by a document mode. It wasn't fixed by a change in the user agent string. It wasn't fixed by a configuration. I would have had to change the code, and I am not changing the code on a server that's showing doctors how their patients are hurt, ever. What I am going to do is put them in an environment where I can test and make sure it works and have that environment be stable. So it's really the perfect use case. I mean, I know we had a little fun, but poor guy's expense, we should all be nice to him. Like, someone buy him a cookie or something. But really, legitimate concern. Right, and pharma has the same thing with pharmaceuticals, right? We have to have validated apps, so multi-million dollar tests to make sure it works. This is one of the things we're trying to target. right? And we start seeing things that were otherwise really hard to fix. Here's an app that was built for the town of Cedar Lake, Indiana. This was a customer contribution, right? Hey, take a look at this one. This one is working really weird. You start clicking on the things, and you're like, that's a really weird, like, navigation is kind of doesn't really work that well. And even if I start going through the dev tools and iterating through, I find that, you know, I never really find one that's great. Right? Still kind of broken even in that mode. I drop it down to IE8 mode, and it's still kind of weird, and it's not working the way I expect it to. Maybe if I feed an IE8 user agent string, you know, I kind of poke at this for a while, and I'm like, ah, this is really just not working for me. Well, let's retry. And, oh, well, with a user agent string and with all of that, but that's kind of hard to do because there's no way programmatically for me to feed a user agent string and a document mode to a website that I don't own. And this is just my city council. Okay. So let me close off all my F12 tools just to get it back to broken. As soon as you close it, it goes right back to broken. Another case where enterprise mode just gets it working. On real-world sites. So full disclosure, what we were trying to design for enterprise mode, we were targeting those folks who were stuck on IE8, and IE8 was going to become the next IE6. So that's our target audience, number one. Number two, we were not looking for perfectionism. We weren't trying to fix every single possible difference between actual IE8 and our emulated IE8. We didn't care to be perfect. Perfect is the enemy of the good. Instead, we were focused on how do we get sites that really exist to work. We worked with a first wave of around 8 customers and a second wave of over 90 with their real applications and investigating. When we exited, we didn't have any bugs that weren't working. I've been using this with the customers who are right now moving to IE11 in the real world with their actual apps. And there's been at least a handful of folks who've said to me in no uncertain terms, this is a game changer. Now, what I think we need to deliver on is how to make that go perpetually, but it really does change the game. And that's what we're trying to build, is something that meets all of those requirements. And as we continue moving forward with our update, we're following a treasure map. We're getting to the promised land. We're getting off of our XP. We're getting to where the X marks the spot. We're like, hey, great. We're here on this brand new application platform. Think of all of the things we can do. When I have conversations with customers who've gone to IE11 or to Windows 8.1, and I say, great, I'd love to see some of your HTML5 apps. No one's ever had one to show me. No one. I'm like, oh, so you got to where X marks the spot. You didn't think to grab a shovel and dig? Because that's where the treasure is. How do we dig for the treasure? And why does that matter? It matters more now because the platform is bringing you more stuff. Think back to the 80s and 90s when you're like, if I can just keep up with the next version of DOS and the next version of Windows, I'll get a TCP/IP stack for free because I didn't have that before. So keeping up was hugely valuable. And then you hit this plateau where all of a sudden there was nothing you couldn't do that you couldn't do on Windows XP. All of the innovation went into the app. Well, it's on its head now. Oh, you want a touch-first experience? Because that kind of sucks a little bit on Windows 7. You don't want to get on that. Oh, you want to have a browser that's, you know, really, really fast and really, really efficient? Well, that might not be, you know, what you're going to get if you don't move forward. Some of the things that could be of value are things that people don't think about. They think, oh, I can do all these fish swimming around our demos. I admit they're not great for the enterprise. I've given that feedback loud and clear. Fish swimming around doesn't help you sell your browser internally. Here's something that might. HTML5 is really, really terse. Here is just the intro bit for some HTML4. Now, let's go ahead and tighten this up to make it compliant with HTML5. First, let's take that doc type and shorten that up a bit. Okay, that's all we need is HTML. All that extra language wasn't really helpful. And let's go ahead and, well, the HTML declaration, that's kind of long too. Let's shorten that up. It doesn't need to be that long. This whole content type, yeah, that's kind of longer than it needs to be. We'll go ahead and fix that. And, oh, the style sheet, let's go ahead and shorten that up a little bit too and end up with this versus this. Same content, doesn't really do anything, but that's just the extra stuff surrounding it that doesn't add value. 412 characters to do in HTML4 versus 188 to do it in HTML5. And if I pull out my trusty calculator, 412, I can do math, good. 188, 224 bytes per page that I'm spending on no added value per page. How many web pages do you think your average user goes to every single day? Too many? That's not a number. I can't multiply by too many. 25 web pages a day total. I can do that on Facebook in 5 minutes. Right? Let's say they go to 500. 500 web pages a day. So every single user, how many people in your company? Spit out a number. 20,000? 10,000? 50,000? Okay? So that is how many bytes, how many kilobytes, megabytes, gigabytes. 5 gigabytes a day in bandwidth that I'm paying for stuff that adds no value if I just transition. Should I do that? There's real money. I know one customer that financed their entire Windows 7 migration just on power savings alone. They actually measured it at the tap and said, we are using less power. And here's how much, and here's our bill, and here's what we're going to save. Did the math. Oh, we paid for it. Bandwidth savings is not sexy, but it's money. And it's part of the argument for why we ought to move forward. Defining that ROI and really understanding, why do we want to think about moving forward and building this? I am taking on the challenges of giving you better examples of the stuff you could build for the enterprise, particularly for HTML5, because I think it's really, really lacking there in the web space, but also on the Windows space. I want to help arm you with that, but this is a conversation to have. Let's not just get there. Let's dig for treasure. And as we think about what we've been investing in, we've been investing in enterprise mode, i.e. if you look at what we've done in Office, remember those terrible, terrible statistics I gave you in Office 2010? You know what we did in response to that? We threw it away and did telemetry based upon the stuff that people actually use and therefore might care about. And we reduced the volume of extraneous information. We might not catch everything, but guess what? We already weren't catching everything. We're helping you focus and manage your risk better. The other thing we've been doing from an enterprise perspective, this almost went unnoticed. I don't know anyone talking about this. So when I think about building Windows 8 apps, the story kind of came out, start over and build a brand new one. And I don't know about your company, but my company already has a bunch of apps that they're not going to throw away. So what did you do? Did you just start over on all of them? Or do you find some way to work with it? One of our great case studies that we have for Windows 8 apps was Emirates Airlines, where they have a Windows 8 app running that the flight attendants carry around. It's beautiful. You know what's behind that thing? It's using a loopback, technically against the rules at the time, to their existing desktop apps. They didn't rewrite that thing. They didn't even repackage it. They put a fancy skin on top of it. And we said, you know what? You are going to be able to use a loopback and to use a brokered component to talk back and forth between those two things. The wall has come down for your side-loaded apps to enable the enterprise to get more value from your legacy investments. And that's what we're driving towards. So that you can be modern and you can be durable. And we're just getting started. Thank you very much.